Good morning and welcome to another International Connection, and happy Easter to everybody out there. We are in part three of a lecture by Dr. Colin Ross. This lecture was called The CIA and Military Mind Control Research, Building the Manchurian Candidate. And this is the first segment in an extended series on mind control in Canada. Next week we'll be featuring an interview with Dr. Colin Ross. If people are interested in where to get hold of audio tapes of this program or transcripts, you can give me a call at 595-1655 during the show or shortly after. This lecture was given at the 9th Annual Western Clinic Conference on Trauma and Dissociation in Orange County, California on April 18th, 1996. And it's very suspicious, I would say, that we have in the news the cult group that has just supposedly committed mass suicide in San Diego, and immediate comparisons to Jonestown, as we're going to hear today and as we heard last week, of Jonestown's connections to the CIA mind control programs. And also the Solar Temple suicides as well in Quebec. And if you remember, there was news coverage, for example, Radio Canada announced that the Solar Temple had financed itself through arms smuggling, laundering its money through BCCI, which is well known for its CIA connections as well. So I think people have to ask themselves what's behind these events, and not to take it at media's face value. Now we're going to play Dr. Colin Ross.
Another person who was brought in through Paperclip or another related project was Albertus Strughold. Albertus Strughold is regarded as the father of aviation medicine. There's a library named after him at Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio. He was honored by the Daughters of the American Revolution for his contribution to aviation medicine, and the Texas State Legislature declared a one-time state Memorial Day named after him in, I believe it was, the 1960s. Albertus Strughold was not a nice person. People on his own administrative level, people who reported to him, and people that he reported to were all tried and found guilty at Nuremberg of war crimes. He was not even interviewed by the U.S. lawyers responsible for that sector of Nuremberg. The types of experiments that these people did included things like putting people in a pressure chamber and dropping the pressure instantly to about 60,000 feet to simulate somebody being blown out of a cockpit if they were a U.S. pilot. What would happen then is they would claw at their faces, experience excruciating pain, and die, either actually die or almost die. The ones who died would be taken out of the chamber, their heads would be cut open, then their heads would be submerged underwater, their brains would then be sliced open to determine whether there was air emboli in their cerebral arteries. Another type of experiment done by these people was to attempt to find an antidote to seawater so that downed German pilots in the North Sea could drink seawater. So these people were given forced feedings of seawater for days on end, which then would be doctored with various different substances to see whether any of the substances would prevent these subjects from dying. This is major, full-tilt, Nazi doctor war crime stuff. And probably over 1,000 of these kind of scientists were brought in over under Project Paperclip. The Nazi war criminals were examined by a team of psychiatrists, including Ewan Cameron, who did LSD and mescaline research, who was an MK Ultra contractor. LSD and mescaline research was also funded by MK Ultra, and mescaline research was done by the Nazi war criminals in the prisoner of war camps. So Ewan Cameron probably got the bright idea of LSD and mescaline research from the Nazi war criminals. And according to this book, which is not real rock solid in its documentation, he was still in network up in the early 1960s when the U-2 pilot went down. So the only people who are missing from this fully, completely documented history are the psychological warfare experts. It is not plausible that the only kind of scientists out of the full range of military expertise that were not brought over was the psychological warfare experts. And a guy who was Deep Ops character in Vietnam described being out in the field and coming across U.S. and VC personnel who are all totally wasted on some sort of hallucinogen trip. And their job would simply be to extract these guys and leave the VC, who are just completely out of it, on the ground. He told me which specific location in the United States would be the most likely place to find some of these paperclip psychological warfare experts, so I'm going to pursue that. Let's just take a look at the brain electrode implant research. Now, let's say it's just not believable that the CIA and the military have been creating Manchurian candidates. It's too much. It's science fiction. Well, what do we know for a fact that they've been doing? We know that they've been giving kids, if you do milligrams per kilogram or micrograms per kilogram, big time street doses of LSD, days, weeks, and months in a year, up to years in a row. We know that they've been implanting non-therapeutic brain electrodes in children as young as 11 years old on an experimental basis. And we know that they've been wiping out people's entire personal histories with 102 ECT treatments and massive sleep induction through drugs for no therapeutic reason whatsoever. But we don't think they would go as far as creating a Manchurian candidate. So it doesn't add up. What we know for an absolute documented fact is that they've gone way beyond monkeying around with some amnesia barriers and new identities. So what's the story on brain electrode implant research? Now, here's a name you might recognize. Well, brain electrode implant research was funded by the CIA and MKUltra in conjunction with the Office of Naval Research. There's a lot of joint funding of various projects by Office of Naval Research and the CIA. The Office of Naval Research funded both Neil Birch and the CIA. And Neil Birch published that thing by Jolly West. Jolly West started the UCLA Violence Project, which was going to be at Vacaville, which is where Donald DeFries was. He recruited a brain electrode implant psychiatrist who was part of a brain electrode implant team at Harvard, Frank Irvin, to be part of the UCLA Violence Project. He denies in his chapter in the book by Neil Birch that there was any intention to do brain electrode implants, but the available evidence suggests that actually, in fact, the plan was to stick brain electrodes in some of these prisoners at Vacaville, and the concept was that you would use this for tracking their whereabouts, and if they were off restricted locations or there was a certain kind of discharge from their brain, you could then transmit a signal to them to arrest their behavior so that they could be picked up by the police. He's also funded by Army Intelligence. Army Intelligence funded Neil Birch. Army Intelligence funded Robert Heath at Tulane, who did brain electrode implant research. We saw him on the previous page. The Office of Naval Research funded Jose Delgado at Yale, who did brain electrode implant research. This is the guy that Harold Leaf sent a patient into. His experiments include sticking electrodes in brains, as I mentioned, and then pouring in various types of hallucinogens to see what would be the effect on their perception, their behavior, and electrical activity in the brain. This guy, Jose Delgado, who's tightly in network, he's famous for a videotape of a bull charging at him, and then he pushes the transmitter box, which sends a signal to the electrode implanted in the bull's brain, and the bull turns away. He also has a series of papers, which are in my Jose Delgado file, where he does this kind of research on cats, and he refers to the cats that he's got brain electrodes in that he's controlling by a transmitter as mechanical toys, which by loose association reminds me of a book called Man the Mechanical Misfit, written by G.H. Esterbrooks. He also describes a technical innovation in an 11-year-old boy who had brain electrodes implanted for non-therapeutic reasons. Previously, you had to have wires connecting the transmitter box directly to the electrode terminals that were sticking through the skull. In this 11-year-old boy, however, Jose Delgado had figured out how to have a remote transmitter without a direct wire connection. He describes pushing a button in this otherwise normal 11-year-old boy's brain transmitter box, and the boy starts being confused about his identity, wondering whether he's a girl, and talking about wanting to marry Jose Delgado. He pushes another button, and this behavior stops. Another experiment with a 16-year-old girl who looks like maybe a mild borderline, premorbidly, involves sticking these brain electrodes in, and there's actually pictures in the paper that you photocopy when you go to the medical school library that's in a journal on the shelf, where in one picture she's got this vacant, stupid grin on her face. Push another button on the panel box and she's pounding the wall. So they are showing actual photographs of markedly different behavioral states, totally controlled by remote transmitters and brain electrode implants. But, you know, these guys wouldn't be using hypnosis to create mentoring candidates. Let's look at the temporal lobe epilepsy military mind control research story just for a minute. Let's try and think about the history of multiple personality disorder. What are some of the bogus reasons why MPD is not real? Well, one of the big arguments is this, it's really temporal lobe epilepsy. So we know that temporal lobe epilepsy has been used as one of the arms of Manchurian candidate denial. Okay, well, here we have how that little network works. We got Robert Heath, who's doing non-therapeutic brain electrode implants plus brain electrode implants on temporal lobe epilepsy subjects. That's all funded by military intelligence and the CIA. We've got temporal lobe epilepsy as a phenomena. Mark Frank Irvin, who's recruited by Jolly West to the UCLA Violence Project, and Mark Sweet write a book called Violence in the Brain, where they're describing doing brain electrode implant experiments on people with temporal lobe epilepsy. One of their subjects had a very unusual form of temporal lobe epilepsy. He was driving a truck in Los Angeles and blanked out and came to in Phoenix. So actually, these people were doing brain electrode implants on multiples. Jolly West said, it could be alcoholics, but the description, remember this guy drove a truck from UCLA to Phoenix. That's a little bit much for alcohol blackout. But some of the other case histories clearly sound dissociative in nature. But they're calling them temporal lobe epilepsy, just like Jolly West said Jock Ruby had temporal lobe epilepsy. There's this misinformation in the literature that DID is actually due to temporal lobe epilepsy, and there's 9 authors of a series of papers in the early to mid-1980s pumping this DID is really temporal lobe epilepsy line. So this shows you how this research works, because I haven't done this, but the hypothesis is now these 9 authors are somehow going to be in network. So the odds are the 9 authors of the papers published in the 80s saying that DID is really just temporal lobe epilepsy, they're going to be in network in this mind control old boy network somehow. I just haven't researched that up. Okay, borderline personality disorder, when multiples are really just borderlines, is another backup strategy. How does borderline personality disorder tie up with military mind control research? Well, DID is iatrogenic. They're really just borderlines. Martin Horn says that. Richard Offshee says that. Martin Horn worked for MKUltra. MKUltra is connected to MK Naomi. MK Naomi was also conducted at Edgeware Arsenal. Edgeware Arsenal is a place where Amadeo Marazzi worked. Amadeo Marazzi did LSD research for the Air Force in Minnesota. And it was funded by Air Force Intelligence. Robert Heath also did LSD research. LSD research was done by Nazi scientists and war criminals. Nazi scientists and war criminals were imported into Edgeware Arsenal frequently. And one of the people that I researched was, I forget his first name now, Wagner Jorg, who apparently is the son of the Wagner Jorg who won a Nobel Prize for treating syphilis with malaria. I haven't researched that up fully, but he came over to Edgeware Arsenal, and I have him publishing research. I have him documented as being a German university professor in the 1930s and 40s, showing up at Edgeware Arsenal and publishing research on antidotes to chemical warfare weapons, and saying that he regrets the extremely long period of time during which it was impossible to publish this research data. So he did that research at Edgeware Arsenal, which overlaps with the time that Amadeo Marazzi was there, who did LSD research at the University of Minnesota. Another person who did LSD research is Paul Hawk. Paul Hawk worked for the CIA and is one of the inventors of the term borderline personality disorder. So this is a little bit hokey, this one. But it just shows you, the theme here is not that there's a military intelligence conspiracy to cover up Manchurian candidate creation with a myth of borderline personality disorder. The point now is sort of a more global general meta point, which is this whole network of old boys in psychiatry and psychology who are covertly funded, who are part of the military CIA intelligence mind control network, are very influential in the history of psychiatry in a kind of nebulous fashion that just permeates the whole field. That isn't part of these sort of one-to-one correspondences like I've been showing before. So it's a matter of the whole mindset of psychiatry, how we think about borderline, how we think about temporal lobe epilepsy, what are we going to react to MPD like? Well, we're going to react to MPD because... So it's more a little bit more vague, it's a little bit more global, it's a little more general. But the point is that the history of psychiatry in the second half of the 20th century has undoubtedly been strongly skewed, not by an agenda that has to do with academic research, not by the best interest of clients, not by ethical psychiatry, but by an intelligence agenda. My beef is not with the intelligence community or the CIA, it's with the psychiatrists and the psychologists who've created a little loophole where they can step out of normal ethical oversight, violate the Hippocratic Oath, get away with it, not talk about it, and just like the conspiracy to keep incest under the carpet, this is all conspired and kept under the carpet, not by 12 guys in a room at Langley who are doing the planning, but just by this pervasive old boy network that's keeping the mind control secret down, just like it kept the incest secret down. So that's another reason this is important and needs to be uncovered. That's the end of the slides. Now I'm going to come back to Jonestown a little bit and fill you in on Jonestown. And then I see that I'm way ahead of schedule, which is fine because I've got a lot more to tell you, plus you can ask a whole bunch of questions and we can have a discussion. According to this Jonestown book, remember that there's a connection between Patty Hearst is being kidnapped by Donald DeFries, who's mind-controlled by Colson Westbrook, who's a CIA Psywar expert, and then there's the food relief program for the ransom by Jim Jones, who's being hassled by William Randolph Hearst's newspaper that ties into Russell Means being on the board. Well, according to a person who survived the White Night at Jonestown, Patty Hearst's boyfriend, Stephen Weed, was on site at the People's Temple in Ukiah and observed talking to Jim Jones 3 months before the kidnapping. If that is true, I mean, that just blows the coincidence conspiracy theory out of the water. It's too much not to be all connected up. According to the book, there's pretty solid documentation that Jim Jones was recruited by the CIA way back in the 50s, and he was a coercive persuasion brainwashing expert who had some churches in Cincinnati and then moved out to California. He specialized in coercive persuasion on blacks and Native Americans. Almost all of the people at Jonestown were not white except the elite who survived. And he was on site in two European, South American countries, I think Brazil and British Guiana, as a CIA undercover operative doing typical CIA operations as part of government overthrow by stirring up left-wing factions, stirring up labor, distributing leaflets, and so on. So he was actually part of standard CIA operations going way back into the 50s. The evidence in favor of it actually being a drug experiment is pretty weak. He says there was drug A, drug B, and placebo. And the point of the experiment was, do either of the active drugs enhance the voluntary completed suicide rate of the brainwashed subjects? But he doesn't really provide any documentation to support that. He just sort of pulls that out of nowhere, so that's not very plausible. Also, he talks about MKUltra in a non-scholarly way, because MKUltra had already stopped, so it wasn't technically an MKUltra operation. There's a lot of, I can't remember all the detail in the book, but there's a lot of elaborate detail about, for instance, Jim Jones visited Castro. There's a lot of connections between the CIA being the site for Jonestown in British Guiana before they went there, and all kinds of visiting back and forth from CIA station in the capital of Guiana to the People's Temple. Like I said, one of those daughters in the Layton family was escorted out of Jonestown just before White Night by the CIA station chief. And it just builds up like that. There's dozens and dozens and dozens of these kind of documented pieces of information. There's a whole bunch of stuff about particular people who were assassinated by the People's Temple, and a bunch of numerological type code and letter type code for how these people were selected and how their last names mirrored the method by which they were killed. So there's a whole just vast ton of detail that leaves me with a net conclusion that it's beyond coincidence. Whether it actually was a medical experiment is not really clearly established, except the most compelling fact is the method of delivery of the drugs. Every night, every member of the Jonestown commune had to go to the kitchen and eat one cookie in front of personnel. And he says the cookie is where the drugs were delivered. So I would say the net conclusion is that it's probably more than 50% likely that there was some sort of heavy CIA involvement in Jonestown, whether or not there was a drug experiment. In terms of how many people actually committed suicide, according to this book, actually only a minority of people committed suicide. Many were shot or injected with a cyanide. Only a minority actually drank it voluntarily. And when you look at the configuration of bodies on the ground, these are people who just drank, died, and fell on the ground. They're all lined up in orderly rows. There's a whole deal about how one of the latent family members her identity was switched with somebody else who had lung cancer. And she was actually escorted off the grounds on the grounds of having lung cancer, but it was somebody else who had the lung cancer. And there's substitution of bodies. There's a claim that the guy who was identified as being Jim Jones was not actually Jim Jones. So you have to read the book to get the whole wealth of detail. But I'd say it's fairly compelling and persuasive, which takes us back into how come all these guys who are connected into network tend to be experts in mind control, brainwashing, coercive persuasion, destructive cults? And why is it that destructive cults appear to specialize in creating Manchurian candidates? So you just keep going round and round this network, and the more you research into it, this is only like partway along the journey. If you actually had a team of like 10 researchers, you would end up with like 50 of these slides with some of it's speculative, but every connection fully documented on 50 slides. So another curious twist on this story is the history of LSD. One of the things that goes on is there's always information and disinformation. One of the strategies for disinformation is what's called a limited hangout. A limited hangout is when you let out a little bit of the truth, and then you go, well, see, we fessed up, but actually you only let out 3%. And the purpose of the limited hangout is to cover up the rest. So there's always a limited hangout going on. Every time a bunch of stuff is declassified, that's only the tip of the iceberg. If we take a look at the history of LSD, something that was not taught to me when I was a psychiatry resident is who were the original acid heads? Could have been like maybe Beatniks, or maybe Allen Ginsberg, or could have been Ken Kesey maybe. No, the original acid heads in North America were the leading figures in psychiatry. The people who imported LSD into North America were the CIA and the military. It didn't get here through street or drug dealer routes. It got here through official military CIA mind control research mechanisms. And the CIA at one time actually considered buying up the world supply of LSD from Sandoz. But like I said, their alternative backup was to contract with Eli Lilly to provide a secure supply of LSD. So these guys were on acid trips in the first half of the 1950s. People who first got turned on to LSD as subjects in military experiments included Gregory Bateson, Allen Ginsberg, Ken Kesey, probably Timothy Leary. Gregory Bateson was married to Margaret Mead, who was funded in her anthropological work by the CIA. There's a whole other dimension of this, which is funding. This is a fact.
You're listening to CKLN. We're about halfway through the lecture on the third part of the lecture by Dr. Colin Moss on the CIA's history in creating Manchurian candidates. Just to remind you, Dr. Ross is giving this information. All of this is documented from CIA's own documents obtained through the Freedom of Information Act. We're now going to start the second half of the tape of this third part of the lecture. You're listening to CKLN 88.1.
Another story about anthropology, a little glimpse of which we capture from Raymond Prince being funded on our MKUltra to go study the Yoruba. This is called Study of Mind Control Techniques by Witch Doctors Around the World. Now, Raymond Prince's hypothesis is that actually it's just a way to go undercover into a foreign country and gather information about the culture and establish contact with possible agents and recruits. But the CIA is, as part of its proper operations in the Cold War, has had to gather a tremendous amount of data on the stability of different societies and countries that are likely to tip over to communism, which involves sociology, economics, military analysis, and anthropology. Anthropology is and languages and linguistics are all part of the operation. So all these people who are the original acid heads are the psychiatrists. And the psychiatrists, when you read the LSD-sponsored symposia, the guy who's the archivist currently for the American College of Psychiatrists, whose name is Sidney Mallett, so I plan to contact. The American College of Psychiatrists is this old boys power club in American psychiatry that I got into because I got a fellowship from them as a resident. No, I don't think it was CIA funded. Unless Mead Johnson was functioning as a cutout. The money supposedly came from Mead Johnson. But that's the way the network works. I mean, that's a joke, but it could be. You never know. So this guy who's the archivist historian in one of these CIA symposia in the early 1960s talks about how he was turned on to LSD by Paul Hawk, who's the guy who is responsible for the term borderline personality disorder, who killed the tennis pro with mescaline. Well, all these guys are writing and talking about LSD as the hot thing in psychotherapy. They are totally on board with it, and usually they're talking about sub-hallucinogenic doses, like 50 milligrams, 75 milligrams, as loosening up the ego and causing these amazing treatment responses, like curing long-term alcoholism in a single LSD psychotherapy session. They're all getting funded by it, they're getting perked by it, they're going to trips, they're meeting their buddies, they're going to conferences, they're getting published, they're getting books edited. It's all just part of the whole program. Nobody in psychiatry is saying bad stuff, dangerous stuff, street drug, protect the youth of America. They're not talking like that. All of a sudden, boom. It's a narcotic and it's outlawed by the FDA. What is the initial response of all of these gray-haired fathers of psychiatry to making LSD an illegal substance? Protest. It's a bad thing. It's robbing us of a powerful psychotherapeutic agent. It's crippling our research efforts. These guys were hung out to dry. They were used by the intelligence agencies to gather therapeutic use of LSD, interrogation use of LSD, psychotomimetic use of LSD. And then when they had done their job, LSD was just canceled from academia. It was made illegal. And then a whole disinformation campaign went along with that, whereby LSD was transformed from this wonderful therapeutic agent whose use was advocated by the major leading figures in psychiatry into this horrible thing that made our children jump out of windows and busted up their chromosomes. That's called a disinformation campaign. And it caught the leaders of psychiatry totally by surprise, which is hard to believe since psychiatrists are such clever political strategists in general. Okay. What about this whole creating Manchurian candidate stuff, which we see now for a fact has been going on since the Second World War? And according to Estabrooks, even back to the First World War. So we now have established for a proven fact that that was going on in the Second World War, and the CIA was working on it in Artichoke and Bluebird, 51 to 53. Well, the Korean War only started in 1950. The disinformation is that our boys went over there, they got shot down, they got captured, the communist Chinese worked on them with these strange techniques we don't understand. The person who coined the term brainwashing in a book was named Edwin, I think was his first name, Hunter. He's a career CIA case officer. This was a term that was coined by the CIA to explain what was happening to our boys in North Korea, who were making bogus statements about germ warfare activities they've been involved in. Now, it could be that part of the communist brainwashing strategy was to talk to these guys about the ethical impropriety of biological warfare bombing they actually had been doing on North Korea. At any rate, they come home as Manchurian candidates. We're all bent out of shape because our boys are talking communism, and so we say that we have got to start studying this stuff reactively and defensively because of what the commies are doing. That is the disinformation myth that's been adhered to by the military intelligence community steadfastly from the Korean War up till the present. It's totally bogus. It's disinformation. It's not a fact. It's a made-up story to cover up the fact that actually we had operational offensive use of this psychological warfare technology already in place in the Second World War.